I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about protecting and growing your money. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Our guests, returning Bob and Charlie Kreitler, they're here from Kreitler Financial in New Haven, affiliated with Raymond James, though Bob and Charlie's opinions are their own. I'm so glad both of you are here. So as of the close of the stock markets on Friday, where are we for the year? Charlie, what would you say?
Well, Faith, right now the markets are up about 2.9%. That's the S&P 500 for the year. Not bad, just, you know, as we're moving a couple days past the first day of spring. And it's, you know, this is a nice continuation of the trend that we've seen for the last couple of years.
When you look at the charts of the stock market gains over, I don't really know how many years, but it is a big clump of markers on the chart that show a really an amazing amount of growth. Have we ever seen a stretch of growth like this before?
There have been a number of quite long bull markets in the past. I don't have any figures here with us today. I think there's probably been five or six that have been longer than this one. But I will say that this has been going on for quite some time, and it's been remarkably smooth sailing. And historically, that's a little unusual.
Now, Bob Kreitler, what do you say when people, I hear a lot of financial people talking about, you know, there's some, we say to each other that there might be a major correction. Not so long ago, we saw one of the stock markets drop 300 points, which seemed like a big number to me. You know, it is a little head snapping when you see that. Is that considered a correction, a number like that?
No, that's, I mean, we've been having 100 point moves frequently, and those aren't corrections.
Even 300?
No.
What's a correction? Well, how many?
I think in terms of looking at the big picture, we haven't had a 10%. We have not had
a drop, by the way.
Yeah, we have not had a 10% drop since the market started on the current trend, which is we had the 2008-2009, and then it has been uphill all the way since then, and we haven't had a 10% drop, and many people think you need a 20% drop. So
that's what 1,500 points or something?
Yeah, with the Dow where it is, a 10% drop would be about 1,800 points.
So that's, wow. So 300 is just in the noise level from day to day.
I see. So, well, that's calming to hear that. So if there are a lot of people in your world, I don't know if you even agree with that. But I heard from a couple of other financial people. They said, oh, yeah, there's chatter among us that we haven't had one of these giant corrections, and we're kind of due for one. First of all, do you agree with that?
Well, first of all, we're talking about a small correction. We haven't had a small correction, nonetheless a giant correction.
So does that mean we're due for one of those? Are we due?
Well, probably due. Does that mean we're going to have it? And the answer is we don't know the answer to that. And they've been talking about this for a year or two, that it's time for a correction, and it's more time for a correction than it was a year ago.
Well, when people say things like we're due for a correction, there are a certain number of people who sell off a bunch of things and they put cash on the sideline over here. They say to their financial managers, I want to sit with my cash. And then when there is this very big correction, maybe beyond 500 points, I'm jumping in with my cash, and I'm going to buy things on the cheap, and then I'll make money over time. What do you say to people who do that? That's timing the market. I know you don't like that.
Boy, timing the market is a tough thing to do. Not only do you have to be right once, you have to be right twice. You got to know when to get out and then when to get back in. And historically, I don't personally know anyone who can claim to have been very good at that with any sort of consistency. So we really prefer to take a strategy of saying we're going to make sure that we're controlling the level of risk at all times. And historically, the market tends to move the most when everyone agrees, but it tends to move the other direction. So the market likes to catch us by surprise.
So where are we in terms of risk right now for people who are lucky enough to have portfolios of any kind? What's the risk assessment?
Well, I think there are many dimensions to the risk assessment. And one of the things that we have been talking about for some time, and actually since 2008, is the world appears to be different. The potential for large events happening unexpectedly, I think, is high. We have the monetary authorities, which is the Federal Reserve and the European monetary authorities, doing things they've never done before. And it can cause huge distortions to the system. And we're seeing it, for instance, in the price of oil dropping 50%. I mean, that's big. I mean, you were talking about a 1% or 2% in a risky asset like stocks. Well, the oil dropped 50%. And just in the last year, the euro versus the dollar has dropped over 20%. These are big moves that I think are indicative of problems within the overall financial system. So these risks are there. And then you can say, well, you know, we haven't had a drop in a correction in the stock market since 2009. There's some risk there, too. And the answer is yes. And when all these things start working together, yes, there is some risk there. But we also know that if you can sort of hold your own on this, don't jump in, don't jump out, that investing through stocks and diversified portfolios can make significant amount of money for you.
Right now, would you describe us, Charlie Kretler, is in a risky time?
Oh, I think there are always risks out there. Today, I think that we're in a particularly unusual one because, as Bob just mentioned, we're in this very strange period from a monetary standpoint. We have the central bank in the United States, the central bank in Europe, doing things that we've simply never done before. And while we are certainly optimistic about the outcomes, we just don't know what they'll be.
So you're both saying we've never been here before. There are people at Yale we've had on the show so many times who studied the history of all the stock markets, and they can tell you things about how this has happened before, that's happened before, here was the outcome. Very valuable, important information. You're both saying, even for them, we have never been here before.
Yes, and that's true because the monetary authorities are doing things they have never done before. I mean, we now in Europe have government bonds selling with negative interest rates. And a little while ago, people said, you can't possibly have negative interest rate. What does a negative interest rate mean? It means if you come to the bank with $100, they're going to guarantee you get $99 back. That's a negative interest rate. And so you say, well, I don't have any other place to put my money, so I'm going to give it to you, might give you my $100, I get $99 back, and I smile. This is unusual. This is unusual stuff.
So I see why it's risky out there.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's an old saying which I love, which is that history doesn't repeat, but it often rhymes. And while we are in unprecedented times from a monetary standpoint, you know, I want to go back to some of our earlier comments about what does an investor do? Do they sit on some cash? Do they try and jump in when the market drops? And the things that keep me up at night aren't the swings in the market, the ups and the downs. We can live with that so long as we don't have a catastrophic loss of the money that we've put in. If I own a high-quality company and the price drops from $100 a share to $80 a share, well, I still own my share. I still have the ownership in the company. And if the price then comes back up later, have I really been harmed? So other than some sleepless nights, I'm probably okay. And we continue to try and emphasize diversification and spreading the risks out to limit the risk that it doesn't come back or I do have a problem with that one company.
So let's talk about some of the things that we notice that are happening out there. And then if you would relate these to us, to regular people who might have small or large, depending on your situation, portfolios from your workplace. So the Federal Reserve, when it so much as whispers that it is contemplating thinking about raising interest rates, it's the backlash to that in the financial markets is so surprising to me. I think, what is it that is scaring everybody when they talk about even the tiniest contemplation of raising interest rates. Why is the reaction as strong as it is? Because it's not even, we're not even raising the rates and the market goes down.
Well, I think last week the big news was that the Fed, in their pronouncement of their outlook on interest rates, they removed the word patient from their statement.
Uh-huh.
So that was considered a very large change, that they were not going to be using the word patient. When we look at interest rates, people price virtually everything in the financial markets on those interest rates. And an investor can look at that and say, well, geez, if the government is going to give me an interest rate that has virtually no risk, then all those stocks and so on, they need to get priced accordingly. And if interest rates are going to be higher in the future, then maybe my stock needs to pay out a higher dividend to get me to the same interest rate level. And if the interest dividend, of course, isn't going to change just based on what the Fed says, so in order for me to get the same percentage, the price of the stock may fall. So all the prices get re-rated based on these interest rates that are set by the government and demanded by other investors. So it can have far-reaching consequences. And I think another dimension to this is that we have all of these investors out there who are trying to game what is the Fed going to do, and based on that, what are other investors going to do? So there's a tremendous system of instability, if you will, as people are trying to predict and get ahead of everyone else.
So that sounds like people trying to figure out what other people are going to do. And we keep hearing that computers are doing these split-second trades on behalf of people, that through this very complicated system of algorithms, massive amounts of money are changing every second. And so is it people trying to outsmart other people, or is it a bunch of schmoes like us up against the machines?
Well, let me argue on this, and Charlie, you may come in on a different direction. But I think all the computers are doing is getting fast-moving changes over the very short term. And over the long term, the price of stocks and all these things is based upon reality and has nothing to do with computers and things like this. So in many cases, they're providing liquidity. They're doing all kinds of short-term trading. If you sell something, maybe a computer buys. But when you're looking out over 1, 2, 5, and 10 years, the value of that item is based upon all kinds of other things that the computer has nothing to do with.
So some people make money off those short computer trades, and most people don't. But I hear what you're saying. I'm with Bob and Charlie Kreitler of Kreitler Financial in New Haven, our regular contributors on the show. They're going to come right back because we're going to talk about the drop in oil prices, why some people are running to sell off some bonds, and how we protect, save, and grow our money in this environment. So don't go away.
You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, know when to run. Never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for joining us. Our financial contributors are here, Bob and Charlie Kreitler of Kreitler Financial in New Haven, and we are looking at how to protect and grow your money. And they make us smarter every time they come. They get me thinking. I hope that's true for you too. So we're going to get into, we've got some good news that they want to focus on in just a little bit. You were saying during this break to me that the one thing that is required right now of everybody is greater patience. What do you mean by that, Bob Kreitler?
Well, that's moving away from worrying about what the stock market did today. And I would argue, don't even worry about it, what it did this week. The market's going to have a 10% correction. And yes, someday it'll have a 20% correction. But the people who are going to be making money over the next 5 and 10 and 20 years are going to have diversified portfolios. They're going to try and keep the risk down so they can sleep at night, and they're not going to be in and out, in and out, in and out, and they're going to be able to benefit from these things, because I think there is some good news out there. And yes, we have a huge amount of risk out there, but we have to have portfolios that can work our way through these things and we can be happy with.
Well, how do you achieve enough diversification in a portfolio to protect you in a time like this? We've all said in this first section of the show, we have never been here before. What does diversification look like in a place we've never been before? Can we know that?
Well, I'm not sure we'll know when we have the best portfolio, but look at it this way. If you owned one stock, you obviously would move based upon how that company does. So then we say, well, don't own one stock. You need to own the market. So people say, well, I'm going to own the Standard & Poor's 500 or I'm going to own the Dow. And now we're moving like that market is, and then we can get into a debate whether you can do better than that by choosing individual stocks and things. And that's sort of a minor question. But then we start diversifying away from blue chips by purchasing small company. And small companies frequently move differently than the blue chips did. Interesting, last year the blue chips did extraordinarily well and made the other parts of the market look very poor, and people who were only the people who had diversified portfolios frequently felt that they had been left out because their portions, they had maybe 15, 20, 30% in blue chips and the rest was in other portions of it. Now this year, many other parts of the market are doing well and blue chips are just sort of doing average. Looking back last year too, it was something like there were 10 companies out of all the S&P 500, which are 500, drove most of the stock market performance. So if you weren't in those particular stocks, you felt like you weren't performing very well. Okay, so now I've talked about maybe we go small company. Then we're going to start going global, and maybe we add some emerging markets. Now, this is just the diversification within the stock portion of it. And that you may want to start being involved in REITs or some kind, which is kind of a real estate. Those are publicly traded real estate. Maybe there's other kinds of real estate that we can have. And then we start getting into bonds. And historically, bonds were sensitive to changes in interest rates. And I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit later, but if interest rates go up, this is going to put pressure on bond prices, and bonds can go down. So there's been a movement to take the bond portion of portfolios and make some of it that's not sensitive to interest rates, and there are other ways of doing that. So now we've taken – we're diversifying with bonds, but now we're going to diversify the bonds themselves. And so these are the things that we would like to get 3 and 4 and 5% returns with, and we're going to diversify this just as much we have done with stocks. So I'm going to – Charlie, whether you want to add more,
Well, I think that's a great summary, and I think going back to our earlier comments about how it really requires patience right now, I think an investor's biggest challenge today remains that the bond portion of their portfolio is really not paying us a whole lot these days. And we've seen the 10-year Treasury hovering, it seems like, right around a 2% yield. And 2% is not that much higher than what we're seeing in inflation. So if we go out and buy one of those bonds, we're expecting to get not a whole lot of return after we adjust for inflation, because that, of course, erodes the value of the return that we get each year. And we're going to get that for the 10 years that we hold that bond. So there's a real dilemma that we've got if we're nervous about that potential for a 10% correction. But where else do we go? And this comes back to the patience. I think that this is where we're much better suited finding that mix between the risky assets like stocks and the safer assets like bonds that's going to find this balance that we can sleep at night, that we can ride through some of those lumpy periods in the market and not just be earning nothing on our money in the name of safety.
As we get to the good news right now, I want to put in one word about this. We haven't talked about this in a long time. This will be short. Some people are employed by companies, and part of the deal that they make with the company is that a certain amount of money goes out of the paycheck and you or not, and you get company stock. And so they're very overweighted in the company stock from the company they work for. It can be a good, successful company. Is that dangerous? Is that putting you at risk?
Well, that's very risky, because if something happens to that particular company, then all of a sudden your retirement benefits are going down. So I would strongly urge people who are not really, really wealthy and really need this money to diversify, to not let this be too large a portion of the retirement funds, and whether that's 10% or whatever it is, but you run the risk that if something happens to that company, then your retirement dollars become at risk also.
Okay. And if your company stock is not doing so well at the moment, and I hear what you just said, does that mean I should sell it now, or do you sell it over time to back away so that you only have a portion in your company stock?
I think you can go either way. I certainly like the idea of doing things over time, so that everything that you're doing is not based upon the value today.
Right now, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would like to jump back on the bonds issue too, because we're talking about the safety of bonds, but when we're dealing with bonds in an increasing interest rate, we can lose money on bonds, and we're not used to that. And so that's one of the reasons why we're talking about diversifying those, so that some of the bonds or those investments are not sensitive to interest rates. And Charlie, I know you earlier today were talking about how much you could lose on long-term treasuries. And you think of them as being ultra, ultra safe. But if interest rates move up, I don't know whether you can talk just briefly about that.
I don't have the figures in front of me in terms of but on a 10-year treasury portfolio, it wouldn't be unusual for that to drop 5% if we see the interest rates go up by 1%. And those numbers are going to change a little bit depending on the yield curve and how much they've already gone up. But I think it's important to recognize, first off, that these so-called safe assets, they can lose money. However, a really bad year in bonds might be a minus 5 or a minus 10. And as we've seen, a really bad year in stocks can get a whole lot worse than that.
Mm-hmm. Which is 40 or 50%.
Yeah.
I mean,
okay.
Much, much worse. Yeah.
So let's do some of the good news. Where do you want to begin?
Well, we have been talking for some time about some of the wonderful things that are happening, and a lot of it's being driven by technology. And I've even heard suggested that we're in a new industrial revolution that's really being driven by technology. And there are examples such as the fracking, which is part of the reason for the huge drop in oil, because huge supplies of oil have come on the market. This has just changed everything in terms of where it's being produced in the United States. If we're not yet a net exporter of oil, we will be. This changes the political situation. We're not dependent upon oil coming out of the Middle East. These are just huge ramifications. And I don't know, Charlie, you want to pick up another one of the technology things that's just changing the world?
Well, I think it's fascinating how much we're seeing the revolution in computing continue. There was a blurb in the paper a little while back which cited the fact that the word smartphone had not actually appeared in the entire 2003 printing of the Financial Times. And I can't swear to the truth of that, but isn't that amazing? And you look at the technology and how it has just absolutely radically altered the world, not just in terms of how we're spending our time and how we're doing our jobs, but the creation of jobs themselves, as people have now made livings by writing apps to support these devices.
We recently had a futurist on the show from the MIT Media Lab and NASA and some other places, and he consults to the Fortune 1000 companies. So interesting to hear what he says. He's talking about an interconnected planet within 5 years, a completely interconnected planet, and that the program development will be in the area of things that make us smarter and make things faster, having to do with our health and our home situations and heating. But these things that are going to be invented have to do with improving the quality of our lives. And so these are things that people will need and will buy. And so I can see how that's going to change the financial picture. When you hear that from this futurist, Is that a pointing us in a direction of arrows up for the stock market in the next 10 to 20 years?
Well, I think it's the backbone for some very positive things. And we've been talking about the negatives, and so we have to balance between the risks that I think are unprecedented, and then we're in this technological revolution. I mean, I heard a quote recently, and I've been talking about hundreds of millions of people worldwide have moved from poor to middle class. And this was a forecast over the next 10 years. A billion people in the world were going to move into middle class. And you have to understand this is China, India, and South America. And we tend to look at things from the United States, and we have all kinds of issues in the United States. But things are happening outside of the United States. And so there's some extraordinarily positive things. And companies are going to be providing the things these people want. And over the 5, 10, 20-year period of time, I think people who own those companies that are targeting those particular markets are going to do very well.
Here we are talking about good news, but just to be a contrarian for a minute, I think, how could that be affected? That's very positive. How could that be affected? And I think of world events where we've never been in this place before. I'm thinking about nuclear attack, diseases as we've had historically that would wipe out massive numbers of people. All kinds of things can happen. But I remember the Yale business school people coming on who know the history of the stock market, and I remember them saying there has never been a world event that so seriously damaged the stock market that it didn't recover. And that has never left me. And I think, does that mean that will be true forever? I mean, short of the planet exploding, is that true? You know, will that always be the case?
Well, I'm not sure we can answer that with any amount of certainty. But one of the additional thoughts that I have that pushes you in that direction is there's something unusual about the United States in terms of the entrepreneurship, the independence, the liberties and things like this. And a great deal of the great inventions that are throughout the world started in the United States. And I continue to see this freedom, this spirit. So, I mean, I'm concerned that, yes, the U.S. may lose some of its superpower status, which appears to be happening. But I don't see at risk us losing this entrepreneurship that's going to continue to drive. And this is going to continue to place us in a worldwide position.
I remember looking at a study it was either Bloomberg News or the Wall Street Journal, and they had charted the major discoveries of our time and the vast amounts of wealth created by those discoveries. And so many of them had been created by immigrants who had moved to the United States from various parts of the world. And I was astounded. I don't mean this as a statement about, you know, all immigration, but certainly a policy of letting people come to our shores has benefited the United States historically. So we'll see what happens as time goes on with that. I'm with Bob and Charlie Kreitler of Kreitler Financial in New Haven, and we are talking about, they are regular contributors on the show, how to protect and grow our money. If you want to jump into the conversation, please do it, 203-776-9677. Easy way to remember, 203-776-WNPR. The drop in oil prices is confusing. I couldn't begin to understand why this has happened. But from what I read in media, I see, half the people seem to think this is a terrific thing, and the other half of the people think it's disastrous. When the oil prices drop, I see the stock market start to drop. And I don't for one minute understand that.
Well, I would first hesitate to say that oil prices are necessarily causing the stock market to drop, because they may be moving together for the same reasons. But I'll say, I mean, from a personal standpoint, as I fill up my car with gas these days and I realize it costs about half as much as it did not so long ago, I smile because I also realize that I'm not the only one enjoying that. And this is acting as a massive tax cut, if you will, for American families. And from the standpoint of the economy, that, in my book, going to be a positive, because you have, there's certainly evidence that a lot of people are using this to shore up their household finances and pay off some debt. But this will also filter out into consumer spending. And this is an economy in the United States that is dominated by consumer spending. I think about 70% as of the last number that I saw. So we think that this is probably going to be a net positive. Now, the question, of course, is it going to be sticky? In other words, are we going to see these lower prices? And I'm not sure that we're smart enough to know the answer to that. I will say that it does look like there's a big supply out there. And all of this energy that has been released in the heartland of the United States is here to stay. And I think this is going to have some significant implications for the U.S., for our economy, and for the world.
Solar and wind added into that. Adam Faith Middleton with Charlie and Bob Kreitler. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Faith. Thank you, Adam, for having me.
You're welcome.
And hi, Charlie. Hi, guys. I've been reading for the last couple of years that these index funds outperform, you know, managed stock holdings some 95% of the time. And I have some managed holdings, and I thought, let me try this out. I'm going to take some of my money and invest in a diversified group of index funds. So that experiment is only a week old, but I'm curious to see how that works.
How are you doing?
Keep
so
us posted.
I made a lot of money because the stock market went up, so that was very exciting. But I know when it goes down, you know, I will get a hit. And that's my question: is should I keep adding money slowly, you know, and increasing my holdings in these particular index funds? And what happens when the market does correct, say 10 or 20%? Isn't that a time when someone like myself should actually buy more of the stock market if you believe that it's eventually going to trend upward?
Oh, I love these questions. So what about this?
Well, let me tackle the second question first, which is whether, if we do go through a correction, is that a good time to be putting more money into stocks?
Right.
And I think
an index fund that follows what the market does. Okay. Go ahead.
But I would argue that, yeah, I think, and even if we're just going to follow a fairly conservative strategy of rebalancing a portfolio to a particular asset allocation, that's exactly what we should be doing. And, you know, a rebalancing strategy is effectively having the discipline to sell the thing that's expensive and buy the thing that's cheap. And that's hard to do when the market's going up, because it means we're selling our stocks. We're selling our winners, which is hard to do. But it's equally hard to do when the market is going down, because now we're buying the losers. We're putting money into the market that has just dropped. I think over time that's an outstanding strategy.
Well, that's good. I'm going to give that a try. Thank you.
Now on the index fund, this is one of those things. Boy, people treat index investing or passive investing versus active investing, it's almost like religion, and you have to be careful talking about it in polite company. I think the reality is a little more nuanced, and if you really look at this question over time, it really depends, the answer depends on what time period you choose to look at. Certainly one of the things that index investing has going for it is much lower fees built into the investment products. And I think it's very clear that that makes a difference. However, there are some active managers out there that have extremely low fees and make a very competitive and compelling offer. One of the things about index investing is that they are completely blind, or the index is completely blind. I mean, with the S&P 500, for example, and I believe it's McGraw-Hill Corporation that actually selects those companies that go in there. So you're really defaulting to say, well, I'm going to allow them to pick my securities. And for every company that does well in there, there's going to be another company that does poorly just by definition. That's an average. So one of the challenges for an active manager is, can we weight into the better companies? Can we underweight the worse companies? And my personal opinion is that I think that there are active managers who can and have shown that they can consistently do so.
Bob and Charlie Kreitler are here. We have more coming your way after this short break. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening to this show. We have Bob and Charlie Kreitler here from Kreitler Financial in New Haven. Thanks to our producers, Lori Mack and Jonathan McNichol. And we look forward to your calls, 203-776-WNPR. I'm going to take a call, but I want to get to this idea of patience and looking at your portfolio, if you have stocks or funds, whatever you have, for in the long term. So we've got a long horizons. My guests are saying this. But if you're someone who's 70, 75, and you're just ending work, you might feel, well, what? How long a horizon do I have here? Where? How should I be positioned? So I want to get a couple of comments on that in a second. Bhupesh, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Faith. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being on.
I just want to voice a concern about the speculative nature of the financial market. Generally in the world today, people press buttons, machines do algorithmic trading, and out of the 100% money that's there in the market, maybe just 25% is in goods and services. What about actual goods and services? Companies are overvalued, and the government is given free money, 0%, to play with. I am really very, very antsy about this whole situation. I hope that somebody does a serious study about the kind of money that exists in the market. I think we should be paying more emphasis to goods and services and generation of money rather than speculation and pressing buttons on the computer.
Very interesting. Very interesting comment. So this idea of goods and services, things that exist, versus computers doing these little calculated, you know, fraction of a second trades.
Well, my reaction is that on the fraction of a second trades is those are short-term things. And even though they may have most of the trades or whatever the numbers are, over the long term, the reality of how that company's doing is going to drive the price. So that's and that's hopefully driven by goods and services. And I want to emphasize services. You get some of these high-tech companies, and it's primarily services and tremendous value added. Sometimes it's no longer a car that they're producing, but what they're producing is a wide variety at this point in time. But I continue to think a lot of this high-speed trading is just short-term, and some argue it actually makes the market more efficient because you can get in and get it out. But we're long-term people, and it doesn't affect us very much at all.
Okay. Bhupesh.
Can I just jump in one? I beg to differ, because I think on a more philosophical scale, if somebody did a study after the World War, they found that most of the finance in the world existed, 75%, if I'm allowed to use the term, 75 to 80% exist in goods and services. If somebody does the same study now, over 30 or 40 or 50 years now, the ratio is completely reversed. That's my fear.
The ratio being goods and services.
Now most of the money in the market is speculative. So if I was to say $100 existed in 1940 or after the World War, 1950, $75 were in actual goods and services, and 25 was speculative. Today, if I was to look at $100,
yes, got it.
75 is speculative and 25 is actual goods and services.
That's
got my concern.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
What about someone who has a shorter time horizon or feels that they do at 70, 75 years old? You're calling for patience and having a long horizon as a philosophy in terms of investing. Does that still hold for someone in that position?
Well, first on the comment I am really loath to try and predict what someone's time horizon is if that really by what we're saying is what my life expectancy is. Because I think we all have a tendency to really underestimate how long people are living today. And it's not going to be uncommon as we're doing retirement planning in the future to be planning for ages over 100. I think the life expectancy right now for a male age 65 is 88 or 89. And when you're dealing with a couple at that age, we're planning well into the 90s. So that's something we have to make sure we're considering when we talk about sort of what are the planning horizons. And I certainly think that we need to pay attention to big swings for a portfolio for that individual, but we want to make sure that we're paying attention from a cash flow standpoint.
Yes, so that raises this thing I've been reading in every kind of publication about these annuities, where big companies are saying, give us a chunk of your money, and then we will pay you a certain amount every year. If you die sooner than expected, your estate or your family gets, I don't know what, say 60 or 70% of that money. And so in other words, it's a loan to us, and we can make a lot of money on your money, and so that's what's in it for us. So, and then you, person, individual, are guaranteed, if no matter how long you live, of having X number of dollars coming your way every single month for years and years and years, no matter how long you live. And these all have little nooks and crannies, and there are various kinds of these, but these are these lifetime annuities. What do you think of those?
Well, let me start off by saying the annuity world is very complex. And what you are describing is what I would call an immediate annuity.
Okay.
Which you put $100,000 in, and then you start getting, let's say, $6,000 a month, a year, not a month, a year. So I'm assuming a 6% return, depending on what age you have, for the rest of your life. And this is a moderately, this is a very conservative investment approach. And it's immediate fixed annuity because it pays out. And you can structure it so it goes for you and your wife's or you and your spouse's life expectancy. And it's a good way to lock in and take away a lot of the risk of the portfolio.
Hmm.
And so it can be very simple. It's very easy to price because you can go to various insurance companies and get quotes from them. And you just want to make sure that you're dealing with a quality insurance company. Or maybe you want to go to two insurance companies in case there's going to be issues. So this is a very solid and solid way of doing it, and you sort of add this to your Social Security. With this, they typically don't go up each year. You'd have to have an inflation rider on it, and those tend to be expensive. But we're looking at how do I turn my portfolio into a guaranteed cash flow that I can't outlive? And what the insurance company is doing is it's the insurance portion of it is we will make sure you can't outlive it. And, of course, they're taking some people that are going to die early, and they're using their money to pay for people who die later on.
Okay, so that's an immediate annuity.
Yes. And the older you are, the better the payout. So, in effect, you're getting a return on your own capital.
But the higher the buy-in, the older you are?
For $100,000, if you're older, maybe you'll get $10,000 a year instead of $6,000.
I see.
Because your life expectancy is shorter. So you're getting a return. The insurance company is saying, well, I can get 2% or 3% on the money. I got to do that. Plus you're getting your own money back. And the insurance portion of it is some people will die early, some people will die late, and they're bucketing everyone together, and it's a good way to do that. So I consider it a very solid way of getting assured, guaranteed income for the rest of your life that if you live to 105, you are not going to outlive.
And there are, I gather, is great variety from one company to the next. And so it's best to read up on this.
Well, I'm talking about a very simple arrangement. And then the insurance companies have done all kinds of bells and whistles and making it much more complex.
That's what I mean.
And that's when it really starts getting complicated. I like to keep on the ultra simple side. And then you know exactly what the numbers are.
And the ultra simple is called the immediate annuity.
Yeah, or immediate fixed annuity. And that's going to... That may give you
fixed. There's a key,
and that may give you your $6,000 a year if you invest $100,000, and it will go for your lifetime and your spouse's lifetime.
And does it have an inflation rider? Because six could sound great right now, but who knows as time goes on.
And if you put an inflation rider on it, you're going to get a much lower return. And the insurance companies are pricing these things so that maybe you want to have inflation protection in another portion of your portfolio.
I see. Okay, so you're not negative about those. You sound like you like those.
In this very simple world, many annuities are very, very complex, and yes, we tend to shy away from them, but this is something very simple, and it fits for many people's needs.
Okay, let me see what we've got right now. So the S&P 500 is up 3% for the year, roughly. And the Dow is up about 2.3%. We have not had what many people consider a major correction, which would be a drop in the stock market. I didn't know this until today's show, of 10%, 15%, 20%. So beyond, well beyond 1,500 points would be a drop. I thought the other day 300 was a big drop. So back in 80, what year was it, the big crash, the last big crash?
We 2008, 2009.
What, that was a drop of?
What, 45 or something like that?
4,500.
No, 45%.
45%.
Yeah, I think it was 56% from the highest point to the lowest point, which was back in March 6th of 2009. So that was a pretty heart-stopping drop. That's more than
staggering.
That's more than a small correction.
Staggering. And here we are, and that money has come back to people who invested wisely. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. And so, of course, you'll tell us what's coming next. No?
No.
Okay. Why do you think that the millennials, I just read in The Guardian, a story saying that the millennials, even though the job market is improving tremendously and unemployment is reaching quite a low, the millennials are still having the most difficulty getting jobs. I thought that the youngest people would be hired quickly because they require fewer benefits, they work longer hours, etc. We can all line up some reasons about why that would be true. What do you think is happening here? Not that you're experts in this, but would you take a crack at it?
Well, I'll take a crack at anything, but I think we have to acknowledge that we're not experts in this. But I think there's a combination of factors here, Faith. And one is that from what we hear talking to other professionals and what we read in industry publications, there does seem to be a skill gap out there. And there are a lot of people who are looking for jobs that don't necessarily have the skills that are needed for the openings that companies have. And we're hearing this from both sides, from the employers and from the prospective employees. I also think we have to acknowledge that this has been a very difficult recovery for a lot of people coming out of the Great Recession, and it caused a lot of economic uncertainty. So we've seen people retiring later. We've seen people reluctant to leave jobs, even though they may have the prospect of a better job elsewhere. And this has really limited the opportunities for people trying to get into that first job to start a new career.
Our futurist said the other day, the guy from NASA and the MIT Media Lab and the Fortune 1000 company consultant and consultant to world governments, said that within 5 years, in the stretch from 5 years to 10 years, all employees will be freelance. That the vast, vast majority of employees will be picking and choosing among various jobs, but everybody will be freelance. Isn't that something to contemplate? Thank you so much for coming in. We'll see if he's right.
Yes, I might disagree with him on some of those.
but
it's been great.
It's great around the dinner table, yes. I'll tell you that. Bob and Charlie Kreitler of Kreitler Financial in New Haven, affiliated with Raymond James. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, great recipes, and value wines at either foodschmooze.org or the Faith Middleton Show, WNPR. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.
Money has nothing. Oh, no, no.